Welcome into Locked On Knicks, another very special episode for you guys today, which actually turned into a two-parter because our guest was so in-depth and such a good interview. We had Chris Herring of ESPN and 538. He's an NBA writer for them. You also may have known him as a Knicks beat writer for about 5 years, a few years ago. And he's also working on the book Blood on the Hardwood, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. So we are, of course, continuing the Locked On Wide initiative to talk about the best teams in team history by today talking about the 1994 Knicks finals team.
Yeah, and Alex, normally in the second part of these intros, I like to get into specifics on what we touched on, but Chris is a genius, and he managed to touch on every single aspect of this team from the regular season through their playoff run, the matchup between Hakeem Olajuwon and Patrick Ewing, the OJ chase going on during Game 5 somehow, and just an extraordinary level of detail in every single element of what happened with this team. I don't throw this out casually. I think one of the two or three best episodes we've ever had. So you guys are in for a treat. Coming up next, we'll intro it, and then we'll get to him. Chris Herring of ESPN and 538 on the last Knicks team to have a great shot at winning a championship.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
His own rebound, back up, off the glass, it's good! RJ brings the Knicks with a run!
Milikina. What he does is contagious.
Oh, Robinson with a catch and slam! Across the lane, Knox foul from behind, count it, and one! To Trier, Trier drives down!
Becomes infectious.
Welcome into Locked On Knicks. Alex Wolf and Gavin Shaw here. In a moment, we will be joined by Chris Herring of 538 and ESPN. And as I mentioned in the intro, he is working on a book right now called Blood on the Hardwood, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. So today, Gavin, as we said, we're talking about the 1993 to 94 Knicks who made it to the NBA Finals. Just to give a little quick background information before we get into it with Chris, because certainly there's a lot of background information in our interview with Chris here, so much so, again, that we turned it into a two-parter. But this Knicks team finished 57-25. It was actually tied for first in the Eastern Conference, but they wound up as the second seed overall. They were first in the Atlantic Division. They only actually had the 21st best offense in the league, but the Knicks in the 90s were not really so much about offense. It was very much a defensive-minded approach. They had three All-Stars in Patrick Ewing, John Starks, and Charles Oakley. And, of course, Gavin, and we talk about this a lot, especially at the beginning of this interview, it was the first year after Michael Jordan's first retirement. So it certainly factored into the ability for the Knicks to finally be able to get over the hump in this season.
Yeah, and Chris makes a really astute point that the two times the Knicks have made the NBA Finals post-1973 in their history were the year after Michael Jordan's first retirement and the year after his second retirement. And it wasn't a coincidence because I think as Chris gets into in a far more nuanced way, that was sort of the story of the 90s Knicks, that they were good, but not great. And I talk about this a little too in the episode, but just the idea that there are two different types of NBA champions. I mean, the ones that just need so many things going their way, which I think the vast majority of teams in league history fall into that category. I mean, you even look at some of the great Jordan teams and just some of the injury luck that they had with Michael never suffering a big injury during the postseason or towards the end of the regular season. And I specifically talk about last season's Raptors where they needed Kawhi, did that insane shot. And then in the finals, they need the two of the Warriors' three best players to suffer catastrophic injuries. And to me, that was ultimately the Knicks. And if the Knicks had managed to win in 94, you would say, wow, things finally went their way. Jordan was out of the league. They stayed healthy enough, even though Doc Rivers suffered a significant injury, which Chris goes into, and that was a pretty significant deal. And, according to some people, maybe swung the NBA Finals. But it's sort of this idea that they were one break away from winning it, and they didn't get it this year. They didn't get it in a number of other years. And because of that, it's sort of this fascinating thing to talk about the Knicks as a collective experience, because they were such a significant part of 90s basketball, and they were so close so many different times, but never broke through for various reasons, Alex. And I think Chris does such a good job of breaking down the details of why that was the case.
Yeah, not only that, but why, even though the Knicks never won a championship in the 90s, and honestly, they only made the Eastern Conference Finals, with the Starks, Ewing, and Oakley core, they only made the Eastern Conference Finals once and only made the finals once. And, otherwise they made it to either the first round or the semis every other time. And, so there's something to really be said for, like, outside of Knicks fans, there's not necessarily that much of a significance for these teams in the NBA at large. But, like, Chris made a really good point later on in this episode, maybe even towards part two, of – the fact that the Knicks were pretty important in the 90s regardless, because they were sort of the foil to Jordan's Bulls. Even when Jordan was winning all the titles, they were consistently considered to be one of the teams that had the best shot of potentially dethroning the Bulls. And then later on of, beating the Heat. And they had all those clashes with the Pacers, and Reggie Miller and all that going on as well. I mean, the Knicks were just sort of at the forefront of so many different things during the 90s. And even if they ultimately never wound up winning a championship, they were sort of one of the biggest obstacles in the way of a lot of teams trying to win a championship, just by the fact that they were the team that was going to, like, beat your brains out, basically. that was just how the Knicks operated in the 90s was, and Chris touches on that too, that there was sweeping rule changes sort of put in play so that more teams could not behave like the Knicks and essentially level out the talent playing field by just beating the crap out of you on the basketball court. So it's very interesting, and just a very interesting team, the 94 team, and a very interesting era for the Knicks, and one that's obviously so important and revered to Knicks fans all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think without further ado, we should get into it with Chris, because again, he's able to provide a level of detail and nuance that we're just not. An incredibly well-researched book that he's going to have coming out sometime next year. And this is a pretty darn good preview of it. So let's head over to Chris right now to break down the 1993-94 New York Knicks.
And we are here now with Chris Herring of 538 in ESPN. He is an NBA writer for them, and he's working on a book right now called Blood on the Hardwood, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. Chris also obviously was a beat reporter for the Knicks for the Wall Street Journal for, Chris, how long is that, about 2 years, 3 years that you worked on?
No. I was on the beat for I left at the very beginning of what would have been my fifth season covering the team.
Fifth season, wow. Time flew, man. But it was a good 5 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a good first season for them, 54-28, and then did not make the playoffs after that. But yeah, I was there from the beginning of the 2012-13 season and then left at the beginning of the 2016-17 season when they got Rose. Right after Rose's trial and everything. But yeah. I appreciate you guys having me on, as always.
Yeah, man. Time really flew those years. I tell you what, it feels like forever ago now, too, even though it was – I mean, actually, it feels like both forever and no time at all ago, like the 2012-13 season. I could barely remember it, and yet I remember it so fondly. I guess this is what it's like getting old.
A couple of guys that are under the age of 30 are talking about themselves being old, and you guys are making me feel really old at 33 now.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm sure if we would be having this discussion with Berman, who we talked to in our last episode, then he'd probably be saying the same thing about, well, you guys are making me feel really old now, but it is what it is, I guess. So Chris, I figured, we just update everybody. How is everything going with the book? I mean, we last talked to you probably
about a year ago.
Yeah, like a little over a year ago now, actually, which, again, time flies. But, you know, at that time, you had just announced the book and you were, you know, just kind of, I'd assume you had started a little bit before you had announced it last January. But how are things going with that now? You know, how are things progressing? And, you know, how's quarantine life treating you and all that good stuff?
I will say this, man, quarantine, and first of all, I hope, you know, the people that are listening and everything and doing okay and that their family members are okay. I know it's a tough time, particularly in New York right now. The quarantine life, I feel like what it does, it rids you of any excuses when it comes to writing a book. It's weird because I already work from home for the most part, unless I'm traveling to go write a feature story or to go to a game or something like that. But it's interesting because I kind of feel like it's changed my daily schedule, even though I already was working from home, just because I work so much better in silence and I work really well at night when I feel like the rest of the world has kind of gone to bed and that there's nothing else happening and no other distractions on social media. And now I feel like everybody's rhythm is thrown off. So everybody's kind of just online all the time and it makes it feel like there's something happening, even though we're all literally sitting at home for the most part. But to your question, the book is coming along well. I feel like I'm not the fastest writer. I also feel like, you know, people that got a chance to know my work at the Wall Street Journal covering the Knicks, I was kind of more stat-based and stuff like that. And a book that's kind of a narrative form book, particularly about an older team, the 90s Knicks, is obviously not that. And so kind of figuring out structure and what to really focus on and what to really spend a lot of time on. And the interviewing takes a long time. I've got weekly calls set up with Dave Checkitz, who was the president of those teams. So, you know, talking to people for sometimes 6 and 7 hours over the course of days, weeks, what have you, it doesn't come together that quickly. But that said, one way or another, I've got to get this done sometime this calendar year. I was aiming to try to have it done by late this summer, early this fall. And I still think that may be attainable. I'm about probably a third of the way done writing it. And still have a few big picture interviews to get done and stuff like that. But it's coming along well. I'm really proud of what I've put together so far. And I really do hope and, you know, in my heart of hearts think that it will be something that fans will enjoy reading, particularly fans of those teams and that era, you know, which is the best era the Knicks have had since the 70s.
Have you had like one conversation so far? I mean, maybe it's hard to narrow it down, but that really stood out into your mind where something was revealed that really surprised you, or maybe someone you didn't even necessarily expect to talk to, but just kind of came up in your research and it was a real treat for you, a real joy.
Oh man. So I have an entire chapter that I've done and finished on Anthony Mason, and you know, obviously he's not with us anymore. And trying to get to the essence of who somebody like that is or was without that person's voice and without that person being able to kind of fend for themselves, you know, if they're going to be things that are kind of somewhat critical or cynical said about them, you really have to talk to as many people around them that were in their life, that were close to them as you possibly can. And so that I feel like most of those interviews were just so eye-opening, but I've talked to several of his college teammates about what he was like at Tennessee State and the fact that literally he had three roommates over the course of the first week of his sophomore year, two of whom went to the coaching staff right after they were assigned to live with them and said, I can't do this anymore. Because he was, you know, they were like, he scares me. He's kind of weird. So stuff like that. You know, stuff where you read about, not read about, but, you know, talk to people about, you know, life-threatening sorts of accidents, you know, where he's driving 100 miles an hour. And not just that, but almost like if you've ever watched, trying to think, like, iRobot has a scene with Will Smith where there's, like, a really crazy car accident where the robots are trying to force Will Smith into a car accident. And it was almost a situation like that where, like, right after it happened, the robots came and cleaned it away so nobody would be able to see what had happened. And it basically the same sort of thing happened with Mason at one point where he was in an accident, going really fast, probably under the influence. And well, very, very likely to have been under the influence given how much he was drinking. And he had some friends in the car behind him that saw it happen. Car spun out. car was completely totaled, and they kind of whisked Mason away from the scene so that, you know, inevitably when the police showed up a few minutes later, that Mason wouldn't be there, wouldn't get in trouble. So just like really crazy sorts of things, you know, and that's not, you know, that's just an example. I don't want to give away obviously too much, but like just crazy stuff about him, both good and bad, and stuff like that. I mean, just in general, there's so much stuff throughout the course of the book that, you know, scenes where, you know, Pat Riley thought he was about to be gunned down, you know, in the middle of a film room. Wow. Just like random stuff, like, the, you know, like stuff that's funny in hindsight, but like at the time probably wasn't funny to certain people.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's weird because it's like I'm doing this kind of feel like the Woj of, you know, the 90s Knicks in a way, even though I wasn't really of age to have learned it. But it's like a retroactive Woj because Woj learns stuff in the very moment it happens. And in my case, it's like learning about the stuff 30 years later that either people didn't ask about or that, you know, it wasn't. My hunch on all this is like the Knicks never won a title. And so because of that, all these questions or all these things that would have been written about them during that time that weren't, you know, for whatever reason, people decided that maybe it wasn't a marketable enough topic. Maybe people wouldn't have been interested. People at the time probably didn't think that the Knicks would go this long without being good again. And so it's like this treasure trove of information that's just out there that a lot of these people either haven't been asked about or haven't been approached about or didn't want to talk about back then that now more often than not are like happy to talk about. And so the information that I've gotten and that I'm still getting, you know, with another probably 30 or 40 people to talk to has just been kind of incredible in my opinion.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts to think about that there was once an era where basketball mattered more for the Knicks and that some off the court stuff could go unreported when now it seems like if James Dolan sneezes, it gets, you know, covered and is a potential back page story because there's nothing really to talk about on the court with the Knicks anymore. So I guess to lead into this discussion sort of about this finals team, I mean, we're talking sort of just about the whole era in general, but the finals team was the marquee, obviously. And you know, I think if we're going to start discussing this, we can't really, I mean, this might sort of be near and dear to you a little bit as well as someone who's, you're from the Chicago area initially, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I was from Chicago, grew up in the Chicago area and live here now. It's where I moved back to when I left New York and left the Knicks beat. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the thing that sort of sparked the Knicks even being able to make this run, at least most likely based off how things went the years prior, is the fact that Michael Jordan retired the year of and the Knicks were then able to finally break through. How much of a role do you think that played in the Knicks even being able to go on this finals run?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's no question. You know, one way I've thought about this and kind of in my notes and stuff like that, Michael retired twice during the 90s, once, you know, between the 93 and the 94 season, and then again after the 97-98 season. The Knicks made it to the finals each of those next seasons. So, like, when you think about it that way, the idea that, you know, whether you saw it as a coincidence, which it probably wasn't, that the Knicks made it every time he retired, you know, and a lot of people will tell you that they should have made it in 93. You know, everybody remembers the Starks dunk and everything. What a lot of people, especially your all's age and, you know, my age, I think I'm right in the same ballpark, that I wasn't aware of this until I really started researching it and looking into it. The game that Starks had that really famous dunk that some people would say was on Michael Jordan, it's kind of more on Horace Grant, and Michael was there in the area. That dunk, that game put the Knicks up 2-0 in that series. And so, you know, they were up 2-0. You know, you figure maybe you split in Chicago and then you've got a chance to win the series at some point. They were up 2-0 and then lost 4-2. That was a series where Michael Jordan had the Atlantic City thing come up in the middle of the series where the New York Times reported that Michael had gone up to Atlantic City in between games 1 and 2 against the Knicks and kind of really pissed him off and kind of lit a fire under him. And then the Bulls swept the rest of the series. But, you know, so some people will say the Knicks should have had a chance really at least 3 times there. But certainly when he stepped away, you know, it improved the Knicks' chances The Knicks never came out and said they should be viewed as the favorites necessarily, but obviously their biggest obstacle was out of the way. And so it gave them a much better chance to just come out of the East. And, you know, they were a team that was built to really play well on defense. They had the best defense in the league and defensive efficiency 3 years in a row, the last 3 years that Riley was there. They were starting to try to add more offense because that had been, you know, kind of their Achilles heel, which obviously came up in, you know, over the course of the season as well. But they felt like they finally had a good enough blend of offense and defense to kind of get it done and to win the whole thing, particularly with Michael out of the picture. And so, yeah, I mean, there's no question that Michael leaving the picture always benefited them, you know, just as one of the powers in the East. Never quite had enough to get it done, but certainly Michael being out of the way helped them have a better chance to get it done.
Were the Knicks at any point that season, Chris, considered favorites to potentially win the finals or make the finals? I know that they finished, I think, tied for the third best record in basketball. They ripped off, if I read it correctly, a 15-game winning streak in March. You mentioned it pretty clearly, the best defensive team in basketball. But I mean, whether internally or externally, was there a perception that this was their year and they could credibly win a championship, or was it somewhat of a surprise when they got there and sort of had Houston on the ropes at one point?
No. I think they were expected to do it. I mean, the weird thing about that season was that, you know, not now, but at the time, there were people that thought that the Bulls might like sneak into the playoffs. And I think the Bulls won 55 games that year, which was like three or four less than what they'd had the year before with Jordan. So that was kind of one of the really big surprises. The Knicks were expected to. The other thing to keep in mind about this, Michael retired 2 days before the Knicks training camp opened. So it wasn't like a thing where, you know, you had the whole summer to consider this. It kind of came out of the blue. And, you know, it was really just becoming news as teams were heading into camp. So it certainly changed the perception. I know that Riley was certainly asked that question about whether or not the Knicks should be viewed as the favorite. And, you know, he consistently kind of declined to take that approach. And the players, to their credit, you know, especially with like the Ewings and the Oakleys, they didn't really seem to take that for granted either. But over the course of the year, I'm sure that they were, you know, probably considered to be that, particularly when they had that win streak in March, like you said, of 15 games. But it was a pretty kind of tumultuous season in a couple different ways anyway. The first thing was that Charles Smith, and you remember this is coming off the year where Charles Smith has the three or four times that he's blocked. That was the big turning point in the postseason before, was that the Knicks had a golden opportunity to go up 3-2 on the Bulls and lost there, and then lost the series. He was coming off of an offseason knee clean out, which didn't seem like a huge deal, but then he continued to have problems with his knees even after the clean out. So that was one thing. And then I think the bigger thing, which, you know, I think younger Knicks fans may not really know or know as much about, it's certainly something that I didn't know as much about before I started researching the book. Doc Rivers was on that team. He was the starting point guard on that team, and he tore up his knee. It was actually the same day that Patrick Ewing became the leading all-time scorer in Knicks history and passed Clyde. He tore up his knee that day in December, and it forced the Knicks eventually to make the trade for Derek Harper. And so that was something that, you know, initially didn't seem like a huge, huge thing because the Knicks obviously continued to win later in the year. But when you look back at kind of what really ultimately cost the Knicks, it was a lack of offense. And, you know, obviously John Starks shooting 2-for-18 in that game 7 against the Rockets. But when you look at the guard options, everyone points to Rolando Blackman, and I think rightfully so, not getting an opportunity to play in that game 7. Hubert Davis not playing much. Doc Rivers kind of views it as something where he's like, I couldn't help but watch that game and think if I had been out there, that Pat Riley would have felt more comfortable pulling John for a while to throw me in there. And, you know, as a point guard, Derek Harper kept saying, you know, everybody blames John. I kind of blame myself for continuing to pass the ball to John as the point guard because, you know, if I don't give him the ball, he can't keep shooting it. So it's like everybody kind of has played this blame game. Pat Riley has literally written letters to Rolando Blackman over the years apologizing for not putting him into the game. And it's something that Rolando hasn't really stopped thinking about either, particularly when you look at – if you go now and look at, like, Basketball Reference and you look at career splits, Rolando Blackman's best numbers against any team, any you pick any team in the league, he always played best against Houston statistically. And so he thought about that for a long time too and continues to think about it. So it's it was tough that the season ended for them that way, but they had a golden opportunity to win the series. The other thing that's really crazy that I think, you know, maybe people know from the 30 for 30s, literally the high watermark of the Knicks for the last 50 years at this point, basically was the day that the OJ stuff happened with the OJ chase. That was the day of game five. The Knicks won game five to take a 3-2 lead in the finals. And it was kind of overshadowed in a lot of ways by the OJ chase. And so it's just a weird season, a weird kind of history when you consider all the stuff that happened that year. And, you know, when I was mentioning Doc before, Doc's injury, you know, at the time you tear an ACL, you assume that someone's going to miss the whole year. Doc was trying really, really hard to come back in the same season, which even now is kind of unheard of, but Doc actually rehabbed hard enough and well enough to the fact that he was ready to come back. And the doctors basically said he could be ready for the third round, but Pat Riley didn't want to risk them having injuries and being a player short. You know, if they didn't make it to the third round or if they needed someone before that, if they're in foul trouble or something. So Doc didn't end up being put on the playoff roster, and Doc was really frustrated with Riley about it for a long time. But that, you know, there are just so many different things that happened and took place that I think, you know, it's hard to know whether stuff just would have happened differently. Starks' uncle died right before the final started. There were just a lot of weird things that happened over the course of that series, over the course of the season, that, you know, who knows what impact they played, what role they played, but a lot of different things took place.
Yeah. Was there ever like any, you know, you mentioned that guys sort of had tried to blame themselves, you know, for Starks's game in the, you know, the final game there. And then there was the decision to just let him keep shooting and racking up that 2-for-18 game, all kinds of other factors, as you mentioned. Was there ever like any sort of, in your research so far, has there ever been, or even, you know, how people feel to this day, because now obviously you're talking to them in, you know, 2019, 2020. Sure. Has there ever been any, like, hard feelings about that? Like, because ultimately this team, this was their peak. You know, they made the, I believe, the Eastern Conference Finals the next year. And then, you know, didn't reach the finals again until they broke up this core. And, you know, went at it with basically a whole new team in 98-99. So was there ever any hard feelings that sort of ultimately, you know, carried over and then led to this team eventually, you know, breaking up a number of years down the line?
No, I don't think hard feelings would be the way to put it. The other thing I'll add really quickly before answering the rest of that question, I think it would be interesting. Like, I've kind of been asking this question of a lot of the players, and a lot of the guys around those teams. The question of which team was their most talented, I feel like you get a mix between that season, the season we're talking about right now, 93-94. You also get a lot of people that will tell you that the team in 97, where they get Larry Johnson and they've got Chris Childs, a lot of people will tell you that that team, they felt like that was their best team. And Allen Houston had just joined their team as well. But that was the year that they had the suspensions with Miami, and, you know, that they had a golden opportunity to close out that series. But then the league suspended, I think, six people, five of whom were Knicks, including Ewing, including Starks, mm-hmm. Including Larry Johnson. And so, you know, it kind of effectively, you know, reduced their chances of winning the series, you know, but probably by more than half. I think most people would tell you that, you know, the Knicks basically were trying to file an injunction, did file an injunction to try to legally take action against the league just to hold off the suspension so that it wouldn't kill their chances of winning the series, which they had been leading 3-1, you know, before all that stuff happened. And then obviously did lose that series. But no, I think I don't know that hard feelings is the way to put it. I think if anybody had hard feelings, it would probably be Rolando Blackman. And he has said that he doesn't harbor hard feelings about it, that he has never made a point to respond to Pat Riley's handwritten letters to him over the years, which I think that's interesting. You know, I kind of asked him why, and he claims it's not hard feelings. But he's like, there's nothing to say, really. It's not hard feelings, but there, I don't have anything to add. There's really nothing to say. You know, he's, I think he said he'd seen Pat maybe once or twice since then, and it wasn't by no means were there hard feelings then. He's just like, I don't really have anything to say in response in a letter or anything like that. But, you know, basically what it came down to, there are some people, you look at Dave Checkitz, he's made comments saying that Pat should have pulled him. I've talked to a couple people that said that Red Holdman was, you know, in Houston kind of talking to someone sitting next to him saying, like, do you feel like maybe this would be the time to try Hubert Davis or Rolando Blackman instead of just letting Starks just kind of fire the ball up there repeatedly? And, you know, Red was much older at that point, but and was pretty soft-spoken, wasn't going to yell or scream or anything, but just kind of thinking, what is Riley thinking here? But Riley was so big on shortening his rotation. He was so big on kind of, you know, you take – the people that got you to that point and you ride them as long as you can. And I think what's interesting, like in hindsight, it's really easy to look at Stark shooting 2-for-18 saying like, what the hell, why would you leave him in? But look back at the game by game logs from that series. If I remember correctly, he was awful in game one. I think he was maybe 3-for-14 in game one. And then games 2-6, he shot, I want to say better than 50% and maybe even 50% from three in those games combined. And in 4, 5, and 6, he was fantastic. He almost won. He almost single-handedly won them the game in game 6, which would have won them the series had it not been for Hakeem Olajuwon getting basically a fingernail on a last-second shot that he took from the three-point line. But he had had double-digit fourth quarters in games 4, 5, and 6. So the idea that he could shoot himself out of a slump, they'd been trusting him to do that all year anyway because they really didn't have a dedicated second scorer outside of him. So that, you know, Riley riding Starks as long as he could, it makes sense. It's obviously very easy to say in hindsight he shouldn't have done that. Like I said before, Rolando Blackman was clearly, you know, a player who had performed really well against the Rockets over his career. But he was on the last legs of his career. He'd had back problems for the previous year and a half and hadn't really been in the rotation consistently. And so the idea that Pat was going to bring somebody off the bench who hadn't been playing in his mind because he wasn't completely physically healthy or hadn't looked right in the moments that he had thrown him out there, it makes sense why he did it. But even Pat has kind of acknowledged that it was a mistake, that, you know, if he could go back and do it over again, that he would. But no, I don't think people really harbor resentment. Oakley's been somewhat vocal about Riley having made a mistake with that, but nobody's outright said that they're still mad or angry or anything like that. I think it's mostly just like, damn, we were close. And that's probably the most appropriate way to think about it.
Gavin, real quick, sorry, before we move on, just for what it's worth, since you brought it up, the stats for John Starks from games 2-6 in that series, 21 points, 7.2 assists, 1.8 steals in 42.6 minutes per game. He shot 48.6% from the field, 45.2% from three, and 76.7% from the free throw line. So he certainly pulled his weight in games 2-6 of that series.
Right.
Book ended with a 3-for-18 and a 2-for-18 at the front and back. So certainly your point stands there, Chris.
Yeah, Starks was a really interesting guy. And I'll always think that the reason that they went to Allen Houston when they did in 96, the summer of 96, which, by the way, is a fascinating year. I'm probably going to do a whole chapter on 96 and the what could have been as far as who they were targeting that year, and both in the draft and in free agency. That was the year they went after Michael Jordan kind of stealthily. But, you know, I think the reason that they wanted Allen Houston was that he obviously kind of represented a more consistent offensive option than Starks. And, you know, to Starks' credit, he didn't complain about it. He said, if I have to come off the bench, I'm happy to do that. And, you know, Houston obviously was more consistent offensively. He wasn't the defensive presence that Starks was, and he didn't really fit the, you know, the idea of what you would have considered from the toughness point of view from the rest of the Knicks or anything like that. But he certainly was the most consistent outside shooter they'd had. Who could, you know, take pressure off of Ewing, take pressure off of Starks. And, you know, I think that's a big part of why they targeted him for sure a couple years later.
All right, and that's all we got for today. As mentioned, we went very long with Chris. He's a great guest, a lot of great insight, so much so that we're going to split it up into two podcasts so it's a little more digestible rather than listening to an hour and a half long podcast all at once. So we will be back on Monday with part two of our interview with Chris Herring, breaking down the 1994 NBA Finals Knicks squad. But until then, have a nice weekend, and we will talk to you guys again on Monday.